From the small towns
to the big cities,
we bring you the stories that matter.
This is
the Our American Stories podcast.
This is Lee Habib, the host of the Our American Stories podcast. We can't wait to bring you these fantastic stories from our team. They work hard day in and day out to bring you stories from everyday life and from everyday Americans. We tell the stories about this great country that may not be perfect, but sure is beautiful. If you'd like to support us and all that we do here, visit OurAmericanStories.com and go to the Giving tab. Join our team in the work that they do and become a part of all that's going on here. We're a nonprofit, and we appreciate both one-time gifts and monthly donations. It's for you and through you that we tell these stories. And now, we have a story of a group of guys that use Dungeons and Dragons as a therapy tool. Also, Bill Bright's short history lesson of New York City. But first, here's the story of an Iowa man who went skydiving at 100 years of age.
Ronald Mason was born in 1919 in Pennsylvania. At the time I interviewed him, Ronald was 102 years old. He's in better shape than most people at the retirement home he lives in, including those far younger than him. They call him Superman. Exercising every day, reading, and helping those around him, Ronald still lives a full life. And so I asked him, "What's your secret?"
"Well, you have to drink the right kind of vodka." "I've had 4 ounces of 80 proof for about 75 years. Whether that has aided my longevity, hell, I don't know. I don't much care. You know, I enjoy it, and I'm not going to give up now because it's, to be honest, it's become part of my life. I don't look upon it as a morality thing like a lot of people would, but I'm honest. I'm an alcoholic. It depends on how you define alcohol. Alcoholic."
All kidding aside, it's no wonder alcohol would be part of Ronald's life. At the age of 21, he got one of the deadliest jobs anyone could get. But it paid well, which was important to him. At 16 years old, he left home and hitchhiked through Canada, Washington, Mexico, and California, seeking good-paying jobs during the Great Depression, while working as a tree trimmer and attending community college in California. An opportunity to make more money presented itself to Ronald, an opportunity that came with tremendous risk.
"I'm back in junior college, back in Los Angeles. And this is 1938. And it was obvious that there was problems in Europe that could develop into a war. Now, I was pacifistic. I was not interested in a war. I didn't want to fight anybody. But I was also aware of the fact that if this should develop into a war that the United States is getting involved in, I want to go where the money is. And there wasn't much money being a dog face. They paid $30 a month."
Referring to those in the infantry during World War II.
"Whereas if you were a commissioned officer flying in the Army or the Naval Flying Service, you would not only get your commission pay as an officer, but you would get half again as much because of the extra hazardous duty of flying." Well, I said to myself, "My God, that's where I'm going to go." So as the war came on, that was in the back of my mind. I will become a naval aviator and get money. The draft was on, and that's what prompted me to have to move. I had to sign in, or I would be drafted. So So I signed up and got admitted into naval aviation training. Now, some of these experiences I had in training, I'll never forget. And I can explain one of those. As time went on, we were restricted to the base because of the war, because of Pearl Harbor. But there were times when we would have weekends. And it was on one of these weekends that I went into town and got myself polluted. And I came back. Now, there was a rule in naval aviation training that if you didn't feel like flying, you would report it and you wouldn't have to fly. That was just a rule that existed. Well, I was in one of the final stages of training, which was training with two other planes. And what we would, the training exercise was to fly in formation, the three-plane formation. Well, I didn't feel like flying, and I told the other two pilots, I said, look, I don't feel good. I don't want to fly today. Well, we want to get through this program, and we want to fly, and we don't want you to slow us up. Well, I gave in. Now we go up, and we do our thing. And part of the training is that you lift up and you slide over a plane and you set it down again, so now you're a three-plane formation with a little different configuration. And we did that, and we landed out in a reserve field, which is common, and we all had a cigarette. Now we get back in the plane, and we do our exercises again, and it's time to go back to the base. Now, here I am flying this single-engine biplane, open cockpit, and I'm the only one in it. And we've finished our three-plane formation training, and I'm on my way back. Now, when you leave a three-plane formation, you would take the plane and you would put it in a nose-high attitude, and you would swing it off to the left or to the right, and you would be going down at a rapid clip, very rapid clip. And so this is what I did. I pulled the stick back, and I went up, and I made the turn to the right, and now I'm going down head first, and I'm slipping out of the cockpit. My head goes up, gets into the wind, and my goggles flow back, and the upper part of my body is outside of the airplane, and I'm in a hell of a position going straight down. Well, to make a long story short, I grabbed the combing, that's the ring around the cockpit, and I took my right leg, my ankle, and I pulled the stick back, which brought the plane into a level position. And now, okay, I survived that crazy thing, scared to death, knees knocking, didn't know what was going to happen. And I get back to the base. Thank God I survived that. I'm alive. And the plane keeps going to the right. And I correct it by using the left brake and so on. Well, I wound up in a loop, a ground loop. I had forgotten to lock the tail wheel. And now I've really learned something. Alcohol and flying doesn't mix. So, and that mantra stayed with me forever. Alcohol in aviators was a very common, ordinary thing. But usually, and particularly in my case, you learned the hard way if you survived it. And I learned the hard way. I never drank and flew after that. I had been in Corpus Christi, Texas, training, and we flew the PBYs,
looking for German submarines. Now, Pearl Harbor hadn't hit. We were not in the war. We didn't carry any depth charges, and we didn't carry any ammunition. But we were just out there looking for German submarines. Now, it's kind of stupid and ridiculous when you think about it. The war wasn't on, and why are we looking? Well, I don't know. The Navy wanted the intelligence, I guess, to know if there were any submarines out there. And they found out there was. Not many. And of course, it varied from time to time. Now, Pearl Harbor hit, and all hell breaks loose. I was in my final stages of training, and it was December 7th, of course, brought on the War of Japan. And I thought to myself, I made one hell of a mistake. I'm going to be nothing but a clay pigeon for somebody to shoot at. I never expected to survive the war. Never, never expected. Even when I met my wife, I told her, I said, look, you're going to be a widow. There's no question in my mind at all. So it's a decision you have to make. I can't make it for you. But I said, I'm willing to get married if you want to do that. Well, of course, she said she did. So we were married and carried on. So that was my mental attitude. It existed during the whole thing. And I wasn't far from wrong.
But Ronald was lucky. He mostly flew non-combat missions, patrolling the waters for enemy submarines, which was less dangerous than the missions of fighter pilots and bomber crews. But that didn't mean he'd be out of the woods. Or, should we say, water.
Some of the most frightening moments didn't involve the enemy. It involved weather, or it involved mechanical failures of the airplane itself. Now we're stationed at Zandri Field, Dutch Guiana, and we're at the mouth of the Paramaribo River that intersects the Amazon. The river goes to the coast and meets the ocean. Now we're completely a night outfit. We're looking for German submarines at night. And now I'm at about 2,000 feet, and my instruments go crazy, absolutely crazy. It shows that I'm going up 2,000 feet a minute. I make the correction, and I'm going down 2,000 feet a minute. And at 2,000 feet, that doesn't take very long. So to make a long story short, I went up, I went down, I went up, and I went down, and I got out. Mechanically, what I got into was when the warm water came out of the river and hit the cold water of the Atlantic Ocean, there were updrafts and downdrafts. In other words, it was like a hurricane. There were updrafts and downdrafts in this area of storm. Now, that's only part of it. The water was coming through the cracks in the airplane. I was being sprayed with water. And all the time, I had, we'll call it the stick, actually it was a yoke, all the way forward, and all the way back, and all the way forward again, and all the way back. Now, the gyration of the plane, as you would look at it, would be, it was nose down, nose up, nose down, nose up, at 2,000 feet. How close I came to the water, I'll never know. But I made the corrections and got out of it. Now, my knees are shocking, knocking again, and I tell myself, the hell with this business. They'll court-martial me, but I'll get out of here and be a civilian. Well, to make a long story short, this was a tropical area, and the morning broke, and the sun came out, and my attitude changed completely. dear.
After the war, Ronald spent a few more years in the Navy, started a family, and became a lawyer, which led to a long and successful career, giving him many opportunities to work on his bucket list. But in 2019, at the age of 100, there was still one goal he wanted to check off.
This goes back to shortly after the war. The Navy had a plan whereby an aviator could, if accepted, could go to Lakehurst, New Jersey and make a parachute jump. He was trained on how to pack the chute, and he would pack his chute, and he would go up and he'd make the jump. Well, I applied for that, but they turned me down, and I think they turned me down because I was stationed at the Coast Guard at the time looking for these German subs that were depth charging merchant ships right and left. So I didn't get to make the jump. So as time went on, I kept thinking, well, I'd like to make the jump. And I decided, well, now's a good time. I'm 100 years old and kind of a freak anyway, so I'll become a little more freakish. And I thought, well, I won't tell the kids about it because something serious could happen and they could feel guilty, and I don't want them to feel guilty. So I got a hold of the Methodist organization called Wheels. They have cars that they employ people to take inmates from a nursing home. So I called her and said, look, I got something I don't want you to talk to anybody about. It's just a secret between the two of us. I said, I'm planning to make a parachute jump. Well, that kind of shocked her and whatever, but she agreed with me that she wouldn't tell anybody. So I scheduled it for the jump at Winterset, Iowa. And this is the Des Moines Skydivers. It's an organization that's a very, very active organization. And the driver was a young lady, and she didn't know why I was going to the airport, except her job was just to take me there. Well, she took me there, and while I'm there, a large group of young people that are doing the skydive thing. They have a twin-engine aircraft that takes people up and does their thing. So, but she didn't know that I was scheduled to make a jump. So this came as a surprise to her, too, when she found out what was happening.
Ronald, along with 20 other skydivers, boarded the plane. After 15 minutes of climbing, the plane door opened. At 13,000 feet, he and his tandem skydiver sat on the edge with their feet hanging out. And they jumped, free-falling for about a whole minute, and made a safe landing. Ronald had finally marked that off his list. But his story doesn't end there.
I get all kinds of questions about, are you going to do it again? And is it this summer or next summer or whatever? But now I'm looking forward to this June or July. I'm scheduled to participate in the air show at Pensacola, Florida. This is an air show that apparently they usually have about once a year. Normally they have about 40,000 people that attend and whatever, and they have me scheduled to fly with two other naval World War II aviators in formation. We'll be flying the old biplane open cockpit planes in formation. So I'm looking forward to that. Now, I have been scheduled to do this for 3 years. The first year was canceled because of a hurricane. The second year was canceled because of the coronavirus thing. And I'm looking now for the third year being a successful year. So we'll just see what happens. The good Lord willing, and the river doesn't rise, I'll still be kicking.
And I'm sure you'll still be kicking. And a special thanks to Ronald Mason for sharing his story. And a special thanks to Monty Button from Des Moines, a listener on WHO. We're looking always for your stories. Send them to OurAmericanStories.com. And as always, a great job by Joey. The story of Ronald Mason, and my goodness, so many people who are still alive who served in World War II. We've done a lot of World War II stories on this show, and particularly Frank DeVita's story. He was the Higgins boat operator on D-Day and made any number of runs. It's harrowing, and it's heartbreaking, and it's bold and beautiful. And his voice, well, it's an important one to hear. Ronald Mason's story, an American patriot and an American daredevil. And if you have a story to share, we want to hear it. Send them to ouramericanstories.com. That's ouramericanstories.com. And click on the Your Stories tab. We can't wait to hear from you. Up next, Adam Johns and Adam Davis have figured out how to use Dungeons and Dragons as a therapy tool.
As we talk to people kind of around the country, and especially people who are not in the gaming or kind of geek atmosphere or culture, oftentimes they assume Dungeons & Dragons is a video game. So here's how I usually describe it. There's one person who acts as the sort of head storyteller and referee of the game. And they know most of the rules, and they can explain most of the rules to the game. And that person's usually referred to as the Dungeon Master or the Game Master. And they sit at the head of the table, and they describe stuff that's happening in the world. And then everybody else who's sitting at the table is just playing a character in that world, a single character. And they have a piece of paper that tells them things like how strong their character is, or what kind of equipment they have, or what kinds of abilities they have. And this all takes place in a fantasy world, much like Lord of the Rings, where there are swords and bow and arrow and full suits of armor and, of course, magical spells. And the Dungeon Master might describe something like, all of you have decided to venture into this dark cave where you can see that there's mildew growing on the walls, there's mold, and there is a dripping coming from the stalactites in the ceiling. You're here because you've heard of a tremendous treasure that apparently was lost in these caves a long time ago, and you've decided you're going to go after that treasure. Maybe even you have a map to help guide you through. And as you travel further down into the cave, it's very dark, but you can see that the walls have been carved out, like somebody has carved them with man-made tools. And you travel deeper and deeper into this cave system until finally you open up into a large room. And in this large room, you can see across the way is a door on the other side of a very large gap. And the gap seems to stretch very far down into the ground. But the thing that really catches your eye is that hanging above the gap, clinging for dear life, appears to be a small gnome man. And he's hanging from a rope. And he sees you as you walk in, and he shouts to you,
"Oh my gosh! Thank you so much for being here! I'm so happy somebody finally showed up! Please help me!"
And at this point in time, the Dungeon Master then says, "What do you do?" And all of the players at the table get to decide what their character does to sort of overcome this challenge or this situation. So they might do all sorts of things. A warrior character might leap across the pit and try to grab the gnome to save him from falling down into the pit. A ranger or an archer character might shoot a bow with a rope tied to it and tightrope walk across the pit and save the gnome that way. Or a wizard character who can cast magic spells might use a magic spell that can pull the rope and get it swinging so the gnome might be able to jump off. And no matter what they do, they're going to do it together because all the players at the table are all working on a team together. They're not competing with each other. Instead, they are working cooperatively towards a common goal. And in this case, the common goal of the game is not the most points. It's not even to achieve a particular goal. Even in this case of the example I gave, you're not trying to get treasure. You're trying to tell a story. And that's one of the really brilliant things about games like Dungeons & Dragons is that the point of the game is to tell a story. And because that's really the goal of the game, because that's really the place that you're trying to get to, everybody at the table might have a different idea for what that story looks like, but they know they're all working towards that goal. And that's what really turns it into a brilliant and amazing experience. As the Dungeon Master continues to describe things in the world, continues to describe whether or not the players... attempts to do those things are successful, and the players get to roll dice to help add randomness and help determine the outcomes of their action, and get to really have the most open-ended gaming experience you can possibly have, where they can decide and try anything that comes to their minds in a very loose rule system that allows you to be very flexible with the outcomes of it.
A lot of game masters, to my chagrin, I don't like the fact that they often see themselves as adversaries of the players. There's oftentimes an antagonistic relationship where the game master sees themselves as needing to challenge, and there's like a, ha-ha, your characters are going to die today because my monsters are going to be stronger than them. And we don't do anything like that. Our goal as game masters is very much to challenge the players, but also to keep them engaged and keep them excited. So we do that by challenging them the right amount, building on their ideas while they build on our space, on our ideas, because we are we're co-creating and collaborating in this game, where that's oftentimes for many of our players the first time an adult has said, what do you care about? What do you want to do? So then the players now see an adult who is playing with them, really playing with them in a way that is very healing to a lot of participants, especially ours, who are identified at school as oftentimes being an outcast. People tell them what to do all the time, very rarely say, what do you care about? What is something that you want out of life? And so this is an opportunity where they can push boundaries and see what happens when they take up space, and then have an adult be excited about the choices that they're making. We started doing what we're doing right now, using Dungeons & Dragons in therapeutic social skills groups, largely by accident. Adam and I both started playing Dungeons & Dragons when we were pretty young. Got a lot out of it. We played games with our friends. We got to use all the mechanics of the games and the storytelling of the game to really get a lot of social outlet when we were kids. I, Adam Davis, was studying drama therapy because I had wanted to use the drama games and experiences that I had had as a performer and then as a drama teacher to help kids become more into themselves and learn about themselves and how they could interact with the world better. And so Adam and I met in grad school, and I started picking up an after-school program that was a Dungeons & Dragons program for quirky kids who needed a little guidance and social support. And I took the game over and realized that Dungeons & Dragons is actually a perfect modality for sit-down drama therapy. So we started using the game a little more intentionally, and then just barely scratching the surface. And then when my facilitator at the time left to go pursue other interests, there was an opening, and I knew Adam from grad school, so we had kind of like done that thing where we brought some things from our personal lives as sort of a get-to-know-you activity in the very beginning of the quarter, and both Adam and I brought dice. We knew from across the room that we were both named Adam. We both liked dice and games, and so we knew we were kindred spirits.
We had that great moment, that sort of nerd nod from across the room. And then after the class, Adam Davis came up to me and he said, hey, do you want to get paid to come and play improv games in Dungeons & Dragons? And I was like, yeah, that sounds like the best. And at the time, the group was really just a sort of drop-in social group. And then when we came in, we started saying, there's a lot we can do with this. And we were both in a state of master's program desire to want to use all the amazing theories and all the amazing stuff that we were learning. And we really had this tremendous opportunity to start diving in, saying, oh my gosh, this is exactly what we can be using. All of these amazing theories, all these amazing things that we're learning, and we can apply them right here, but through the game of Dungeons & Dragons that we grew up playing.
We We got our first group going. The parents saw the outcomes. The parents started talking to other parents, inviting us to speak at other engagements. And then all of a sudden, the ball started to roll. And then before we knew it, we have continued to grow. And we are now full-time therapeutic game masters and executive directors of Game to Grow. We have a sort of a theory at Game to Grow where players play the characters that they need to play. So we have a lot of players who, like I said, are socially isolated, who don't have a lot of social aptitude, and they don't really have a lot of experience being charismatic or confident, but they pick characters who are aspirational. A lot of players come in and they pick characters who are military leaders, who have on their character sheet that they are very charismatic, that people believe in them. And so we know right away that that's something that that these young people want to play with and want to explore. We have players that come in choosing to play characters that are very similar to themselves, lone wolves who are very isolated in the game. And then we can help that character grow, and thus the player grow. And that lone wolf character who wants to go off and solve every problem by themselves, now we put them in a situation in the game where their character needs to rely on somebody else. Because Dungeons & Dragons is a fellowship game. It's a game where every character has a unique and special ability that makes them special. And that's a great life lesson, is that you can't do everything by yourself. And people are going to rely on you, and you are going to rely on people. And here's what that looks like to ask for help. And here's how good it feels to be able to be the person who can step up and help out the team.
In one particular instance where a player really made a choice that I was not expecting, the characters had all made their way through this dungeon, and they came up into a room where there was, in one corner of the room, a massive troll of legend who had been imprisoned there. And in the other corner of the room was a series of three unlabeled switches. And across the other side of the room was a metal door that was closed. And it quickly was explained to the players that one of the three unlabeled switches would open the door on the other side of the room, allowing them to progress further into their dungeon. And the other two switches, when pulled together, would release the massive troll of legend upon the players, but also upon the world itself. And usually how this works is that it's sort of an interesting challenge where the players can talk to the troll. They can figure out, is the troll lying to us about which switch is which? And it's sort of a mix of a puzzle and a social challenge. In this case, we had one player who had just joined the group, and the player had described their character as being impulsive and having a lot of hyperactivity. And it was an appropriate character for that player to play because that player also struggled with those exact same challenges. And that player said, I run across the room and I pull all three switches at once. And I've run that scenario several times. That was the first time anybody had ever just decided to pull all three switches. So all of a sudden, I had to decide, okay, well, what's going to happen here? And what are the consequences of effectively just running ahead? And all the other players at the table had gotten out, like, graph paper, and they were getting ready to, like, solve the puzzle. And they just stood and stared slack-jawed at their teammate who might have just done them all in. And what I said was the troll runs across the room and he picks up the impulsive player's character, getting ready to eat them whole. And all the other characters, I said, you're the players at the table. I said, you can leave now. The door is open. But if you leave, you'll be leaving your teammate to be eaten by this massive troll of legend. And you'll also be leaving the troll to wreak havoc upon the world. You need to decide what your characters would do here. They are heroes in this world. What would they do? And they turned and they debated it with each other, and they eventually decided that they would help their teammate. And so they enticed the troll back into the cage and re-imprisoned the troll. And at the end of that session, we always do a checkout at the end of every session. At the end of that session, the players all checked out with each other, and the impulsive player said, I'm really glad that you guys helped me out there, because my character is really impulsive and it's clear that they're going to have to learn how to be less impulsive. And I'm hoping that your characters will help teach them that. And one of the other players at the table also said in the checkout, I'm super glad that you did that, because we're all here to basically learn how to navigate this space, how to learn these skills and be better at this. And your character doing that helped make me feel like I really belong here. I've struggled with some of the same challenges, and it helped me feel like I belong. And it was an amazing moment for them to realize that they're all in a similar place, and they've all struggled to make friends, to connect with people. And this is a place where that doesn't matter, where they can all get along, and where they can maybe have missteps, but they can feel a sense of acceptance here.
Part of our mission is to get more games into more communities around the country and around the world. We have traveled and we've done presentations and trainings for therapists who want to get involved. So what we've seen is that a lot of therapists don't have a lot of experience with role-playing games. And then the big barrier to entry, they hear the stories, they get excited, they want to participate in this emerging intervention strategy, but they're under-experienced in a game like Dungeons & Dragons. So one of our missions is to create a product that they can then take and it'll help them get started much faster. This project is called Critical Core. It is a beginner box for therapeutic game masters to start helping their participants almost right out of the box. So it's got a really simplified rule set. It's got a facilitator's guide for how to facilitate the game to be a positive pro-social environment with all the improv and all the stuff that we have added on as incorporating the play therapy and drama therapy that we have into our game. But then also it's got a very specific module design where the storylines are directly related to a real-world areas of social growth. So we might have the room that fills up with lava, and that's a way to build frustration tolerance. Or the players have to go and get past a guard, and that guard might have a slightly downturned mouth that looks like a frown, and then we can work on theory of mind skills and perspective taking, where now we can talk about nonverbal social cues, and the fact that that guard being sad or upset has nothing to do with you. You have no idea why he's making that facial expression, but in order to get past the guard into the next room in the dungeon or in the castle, we have to be able to relate to him, understand him, and communicate with him. So those three components going into Critical Core, I think, will really be how we can get this project out there. We like Microsoft's vision of a computer on every desk. We want a game on every desk, a game in every school, a game in every hospital, a game in every clinic and therapist's office. That is our mission.
So we don't want people to just game more. We want people to game better.
Don't just game.
Game to grow.
And what an interesting story. At first, when I was reading about it, I thought, why should I care? But as so often happens here on this show, you start to hear the story and you go, my goodness, what an interesting way to do therapy. Therapeutic game masters. And it just, well, it makes sense. For certain people, what a great way to reach them. And we've been telling Adam Johns and Adam Davis' story. Great job on this, Robbie. Robbie just sort of bumped into it. These guys are in Kirkland, Washington. And we love to tell stories from all over this great country. Big ones, small ones. Again, Adam Johns and Adam Davis. Game to grow. And I love what they said. Don't just game more. Game better. If you love what you're listening to and the stories we bring you every week, please give us a 5-star rating. It really helps us out on Apple Podcasts and Spotify or whatever platform you listen to us on. And finally, one of our regular contributors, Bill Bright's short history lesson of New York City in a way you've probably never heard.
Manhattan, Manahata, the Algonquin's island of hills, is 12.5 miles long and 2.5 miles wide at its broadest point. Every day, 1.5 million people ride its buses and 3.5 million its subways. Each fare was $2.75 when my wife and I left the city for New Hampshire. But 59,000 commuters now ride free on the Staten Island Ferry. Ben Sweeney, a Staten Island historian, defines a ferry as a function rather than a boat, waterborne transportation regularly crossing some body of navigable water for the convenience of persons, vehicles, and animals. The first Staten Island ferry of which we know started in 1708. It ran between William Street in Manhattan and the watering place, now Tompkinsville, on the east shore of Staten Island. Oarsmen powered the first ferries. Later, someone devised a horse-driven treadmill to propel the boats. In 1810, Cornelius Vanderbilt, a handsome, profane Staten Islander, borrowed $100 from his mother to run a ferry from Stapleton, another East Shore town, and the foot of Whitehall Street. 7 years later, he launched the first steam ferry, the Nautilus, and charged an extortionate 25-cent fare, children half price. By contrast, the nickel fare was sacrosanct for most of the 20th century, rising to 25 cents and then 50 cents only under pressure of the city's fiscal crises. Then on July 4th, 1997, Mayor Giuliani decreed there would be no more fare, just in time for that year's mayoral elections. For 5 years, five mornings a week, I walked to the ferry terminal in St. George, Staten Island, to catch a ferryboat. From its bow, Manhattan's towers gleamed on the horizon like the fabled city of El Dorado, or like a vision of the city of God. The boat rumbled from its slip past the great bronze statue on Bedloe's Island. My paternal grandfather saw the same statue from an immigrant ship in 1906. He was then an 18-year-old adventurer who had escaped conscription into the armies of the Tsar by crossing the border into Austrian Poland beneath the load in a manure wagon. He had thence made his way through Austria, Germany, and Belgium, where he quickly picked up a sound idiomatic French, which he could speak well into his ninth decade, and then to England, whence he sailed from Southampton. Within a century of his arrival, his experience of a long sea passage, closing with the vision of a mighty woman, her lamp, the imprisoned lightning, has become uncommon, if not unknown. Men and women no longer come here in steerage. They land from airplanes, something of which my grandfather probably had no knowledge in 1906, a practical technology even now barely a century old. So, too, we have changed how we carry freight across the seas. Now the great container ships glide past St. George to Elizabethport and the Bay of Newark, where the containers stand stacked for transfer to train and truck. Of the hundreds of ships that once daily lined Manhattan's shores with a forest of masts, only a few cruise liners now swing at anchor. At Whitehall, in Lower Manhattan, swift currents and contrary winds bumped my boat into its slip. Nearby, a pile driver alternated puffs of steam with hammer blows as it drives a wooden pile into the harbor floor. It was probably the last working steam-powered machine in Manhattan, if not the city. Nothing more surely measures progress than the obsolescence of steam, the driving force of the Industrial Revolution. The city's last steam locomotives, the Brooklyn Eastern District Terminal's oil-burning switchers, serving the waterfront north of the Navy Yard, dropped their fires in 1962. The last steam ferryboat, the Verrazano, stopped all engines in 1981. New York is older than Philadelphia or Boston, yet only a handful of pre-revolutionary buildings have survived. St. Paul's Chapel on Lower Broadway is the only one in Manhattan. Walking uptown, I often unfairly contrasted the city with John D. Rockefeller's colonial Williamsburg. Manhattan's past exists side by side with the present, and though fragmented, often remains oddly alive. Williamsburg was barely a ghost town when Rockefeller began restoring what had been Virginia's colonial capital. Today, the hamlet is beautifully restored and maintained. It presents a careful, corporate, and inoffensive vision of colonial history. Downtown's tortuous, irregular streets are those laid out by the Dutch and the English, except Broadway, which was an Indian trail running north from the Battery before the white men came. Some street names have changed, usually for political reasons. Crown Street was renamed Liberty. But most remain the same. The indispensable AIA Guide to New York City notes that Pearl Street was once the edge of the island where mother-of-pearl oyster shells littered the beach. Wall Street, the most famous, was the site of the northern boundary of New Amsterdam, where a wall was erected against the English and the Indians. Of course, there have been no beavers on Beaver Street for nearly 300 years. In 1771, the royal government erected a gilt bronze equestrian statue of King George III and a black iron fence with ornamental crowns. After the first reading of the Declaration of Independence on July 9, 1776, up at the Commons, just south of today's City Hall, a mob of patriots came downtown, toppled the statue, and broke off the crowns. The statue was broken up and carried away and melted for shot. A fountain has taken its place. The fence remains. Downtown's tangled streets contrast with the grid of right angles and straight lines imposed on most of Manhattan by a board of street commissioners in 1807. Their plan was memorialized on the Randall map, named after John Randall Jr., the engineer and surveyor who created it and drew it by hand. Nearly 25 years ago, Harry Kleiderman pulled me into the Manhattan Borough President's Topographical Bureau. Harry worked there. He was tough, profane, and worldly, and I liked him a lot. His romanticism escaped only in kindness to his friends, love of history, and fidelity to the memory of Tammany Hall. The hall had gotten him his jobs. He had been a pick and shovel man for the Borough Department of Works, now part of the Department of Transportation, a confidential secretary to a municipal court justice, and then a clerk in the Topographical Bureau. We gossiped about politics. Then Harry asked whether I wanted to see the Randall map. He opened the cabinet with the reverence one might reserve for the Ark of the Covenant. The map had been made in several parts and was mounted on rollers so cracks wouldn't form along fold lines. Harry unrolled part of it. Randall had drawn and named the streets with India ink and watercolored the landforms. There was the Collect Pond and Minetta Brook and Kipps Bay and the rolling hills of Chelsea that would all soon vanish beneath the pavements and landfills of the city. The map was perfect and exquisite. The Topographical Bureau and its predecessors maintained it as if it were the Holy of Holies because, in a worldly way, it is. It's the root of all land use in Manhattan. I lightly touched its edge for a moment. It's made of a heavy parchment to endure for the ages. The Randall map is one of the few objects I've touched that is so rare and unusual as to be literally priceless. Then Harry rolled it up again and closed the drawer.
And you've been listening to Bill Bright give a short history lesson of New York, his own personal history lesson of New York. And by the way, I used to give my own personal tours in New York City because I knew so much about the place and basically walked most of the five boroughs because back when I was a kid, well, folks let you. Your parents let you. And so from Orchard Beach and the Bronx all the way to Coney Island, because I love to swim and I love the water. And boy, is there a lot of water around New York City. And the Hudson River, which people started to swim in by the 1990s, and by now people swim in it regularly. And it is a city with many bridges, many tunnels, and a whole lot of interesting dimensions beyond Manhattan. When you go there, hit Orchard Beach, hit Coney Island. They're two beautiful spots in a beautiful city. If you've missed any of our previous podcasts, please go back and listen to them. We have the story of the cloud-juicing entrepreneur who bottles rainwater, the story of Ford versus Ferrari and the making of the Ford GT, and also the story of Shayana Rashid, the woman whose family was in the KKK and who in the end married a Muslim man, plus many, many more. Thanks for listening. I'm Lee Habib, and this is the Our American Stories podcast.